Welcome back to the Man Catholic Podcast. I'm Steve Priest.
I'm Thomas Wirtz.
I'm Brock Martin.
And I'm John Bishop.
Today we're asking the question, why can't I wear a condom? This time. Ooh. All right, we are here with Dr. John Bishop.
Doctor.
Okay, so you got to know your appropriate titles, John.
Yeah,
Dr. Love today.
you worked really hard for that, Dr. Love.
I am indeed, Dr. John Bishop.
Dr. John Bishop. Yep. Now, John, you work here with Focus. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do here at Focus before we dive into today's topic.
Yeah, I hail originally from the great city of Des Moines, Iowa. I am the second of six kids. My brother Zach actually listens to this podcast sometimes.
Oh, nice.
And so,
sometimes? What's up,
sometimes.
Zach?
Zach.
Come on, Zach.
You're in there.
Better be listening to this one.
Yeah, yeah. So, Zach, I hope you're doing well. He usually listens to these while he travels. So, shout out to wherever you
Safe
are right
travel,
now,
Zach.
Yeah, I went to Benedictine College. Oh, right. I was a year ahead of the great Brock Martin.
So, you're pretty old. Because Brock's really
I am
old.
By far the youngest person here. I want to make that clear. by 1 year.
But yeah, at least in relation to me. You know, at BC, I studied economics and philosophy, thought I was going to be an attorney, and since that time have kind of run around the Catholic world. So I left BC, went to Baylor University, was first in a PhD program in philosophy, and then I took a little detour, went to the seminary for a year, and found myself eventually working for Focus and simultaneously getting a doctorate in theology. I got the doctorate at Catholic U, and so for several years, I was a student at Catholic U, taking classes, teaching classes there, and I basically am a jack of all trades for Focus. So the thing within Focus that I kind of drive the most is I'm the national point for a summer program called Focus Summer Projects, which I love. And outside of that, I do any number of things, write things, teach missionaries, manage a number of folks.
Yeah. And well, you're one of those like really smart, holy dudes that any Catholic organization, any organization would be happy to have. And so when I see you walking through the halls, I always think, gosh, I'm glad that guy's on our team.
He's also super relatable though. When John was in graduate studies at Baylor, I got placed as a missionary there. My first year as a missionary, and John was crazy busy because you were taking all these classes, but you still found time to invest in some younger guys, and you had this thing called Smoke on Our Porch on
Soup.
Thursday nights.
Smoke
all
on Our Porch.
All these dudes would come over to John's porch, and you would always have this really just awesome, intellectually stimulating topic that we would all be smoking stuff, and it had to be legal stuff.
But,
yeah.
We were all smoking cigars and pipes and whatnot, but no, I wanted to shout that out, that you are a smart guy, but you are super relatable, and I think that's why it's awesome that you're here.
Yeah. Tell us, too, though, your connection to the theology of the body and the topic that we're going to kind of talk about.
Yeah, theology of the body is something which for me has not only been an academic study, but like a 10-year wrestling match. I am especially, I say as a young person, I think I can still call myself young, 33 years old. But in high school, in college, there were a number of times where I, for periods of time, really wrestled with the faith, fell away from the faith. And a lot of the times, the church's sexual teachings were things which were simultaneously attractive to me, but difficult to attain to personally, and then at an intellectual level, difficult to assent to. Mm. So both building the virtues in myself was, you know, still a struggle. Some of the more controversial teachings of the church were things which, at different points, constituted stumbling blocks in my journey. The church's teaching on same-sex attraction, homosexual acts, contraception was one of them. A number of other things.
Yeah. And that's what we're talking about today is contraception. Why can't I wear a condom? And specifically in marriage, right? Because sex outside of marriage is a different podcast, and maybe we'll have that one later. But we're looking at contraception inside of marriage. And this is a tough one for a lot of people, and even a lot of faithful Catholics. And so I think it's a fantastic topic that we go into. And a little spoiler alert, looking at natural family planning, what a lot of Catholics know as NFP, Catholics will use that as a contraceptive in their marriage. And so what does that even mean? How can that be possible? And so we're going to dig into that a little bit. But why don't we start just with what, give us, John, if you could, Dr. John, sorry. Do you like Dr. John or Dr. Bishop?
Dr. J.
That's like John. A radio personality. I'm Dr. here, J. Dr. J. Late night with Dr. J.
John is fine.
Okay, John, that you literally took out. Okay.
Hey, wait, can I cue it up? Just yeah. Like the contraception topic. Because yeah. Early, mid first half of the 20th century, Christian churches actually started to first talk about this.
That's right.
And begin to allow it to some degree.
That's right.
And in the 60s, 1960s, we all hopefully know the history that the Catholic Church stood strong. Pope St. Paul VI released the document Humanae Vitae, which a lot of people in the church were expecting was going to say, oh, wow, Catholics now can actually use contraception. Yep. And he said, no, you are not allowed to use artificial contraception.
Yeah.
And you actually can't abstain from openness to life unless you have some serious reason. So this teaching of the church for, what's the math, 60 years, has been a huge issue that many Catholics disregard.
That's right.
But it's such an important piece of our Catholic sexuality and marriage and family life.
I couldn't agree more, Thomas. And I think so many other issues stem from this issue in marriage and in relationships. And what was going on in the 60s is sexual revolution, right? So everyone's saying, hey, let's go have crazy sex all the time with anyone. And here the church is digging its heels in and saying, no, we are going to stand strong. But I want to go back to, we have to lay a foundation of marriage and what marriage is and why it's important, because that is what makes sense of excluding contraception,
right.
is the value of marriage. John, can you talk about the marriage as a reflection of the Trinity, if you will, and kind of the value of marriage so that then we can look at why it doesn't make sense to bring in contraception?
Totally. Yeah. And Thomas, I want to highlight something that you said before I launch into this, that the church's teaching on contraception is utterly clear. It is not acceptable. The church has never wavered on that position. In 1968, when Humanae Vitae was released, so many people were expecting the church to change and to go into a different direction than it would. Contraception was actually not addressed at the Second Vatican Council. Pope Paul VI commissioned a group of people to study the issue. And the leading scholar who sort of wrote the opinion, if you will, that was eventually adopted or affirmed is a better word by the church, that scholar was Cardinal Karol Wojtyła, who would go on to write Theology of the Body. And if you read the first and the last lecture, and something that I'm going to talk about in response to your question, Steve, is that I really think, having read Theology of the Body so many times now, studied, I just finished a 300-page dissertation on it.
Were there pictures in there? Scratch and sniff? Was it?
Real quick.
Karol Wojtyła became just
Pope St. John Paul II.
Great.
Yeah. So prior to becoming Pope, John Paul II was Cardinal Karol Wojtyła. He was a college professor, two doctoral degrees, and he was very interested in sex ethics, coached a lot of married couples. And the teachings that he wrote, I think, are a particular gift to the church. So when we ask what is marriage, this treasure, which is Theology of the Body, is something that the Lord gave to us at a particularly appropriate time in history. You know, it seems as though whenever things are really confused in the world on a particular set of issues, that's when the Lord just seeks to just bless us on those issues. So you might think of like the early history of the church and all the confusion about the incarnation, who Christ was, how can somebody be both God and man at the same time? It was during that time of confusion, of heresy about the incarnation, that some of the most beautiful treatises in the history of the church were ever written on the topic. And so you talk about the 1960s and utter confusion when it comes to sexuality. That's a reason to be scared as a Catholic, you know, and you might think of our times now, transgenderism and all the confusion, you know, personal pronouns and things that are going on in the world right now. I mean, it's horrible. What is the confusion about sexuality right now? But it's also a reason to be very hopeful. Because God never loses.
Totally.
And if there's something bad going on in the world, He's gonna respond, and He has in this issue, especially on these issues. So let's talk about marriage in general. Let's talk about its relation to the Trinity. By the way, this is not just John Paul II. You can see references in Benedict XVI. You can see references in Francis and his writings on marriage, drawing a parallel between married love as it's experienced by humans, men and women, children, and the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay, you might draw a basic parallel like this, that when we talk about the relations between the members of the Trinity, you have the Father eternally giving himself to the Son, receiving the love of the Son back, and from the two proceeds the love, which is the Holy Spirit. Okay, three persons and one God. Okay, we've heard it so many times as Catholics. What many people have not thought about is that, well, how does married love play out? You know, oftentimes, well, you have a man pursuing and giving himself to his bride. You have the bride receiving that love and giving herself back to the husband. And then from the two, in the usual course of events, proceeds children. And there's something about this experience, which is married love, that speaks to our deepest desires, not just our deepest carnal desires, but our deepest needs as humans. Mm-hmm. You might think of, for example, the desire for deep unity, the desire to know another person and to be known by another person, and not just in some abstract, disconnected way, but in the whole facet of our incarnate, you know, beings. Mm-hmm. And so theology of the body, the watermark, if you will, that runs from the first audience to the end is something called the spousal analogy. What does the spousal analogy say? Well, what any analogy says is that, you know, something is like another thing. And there's a lot of analogies about God's love. God's love is indeed like the love of a good father, a good friend. You know, God is the divine physician. There's so many ways to speak about God that pull out, you know, some dimension of his love. But what John Paul II just brought through the front door of Catholic theology and introduced to the whole church, or at least affirmed for the whole church, is that the love of God is indeed like the love of a good spouse. Mm-hmm. And the things that spousal love, that romantic love pulls out of us, the ways in which, you know, romance speaks to the masculine and the feminine heart, that those things that are awakened in us by romantic love find their ultimate fulfillment in the spousal love of God. Mm. And so the tastings that we get here on earth, in marriage, in romance, things that are awakened therein have an ultimate terminus in heaven. And so, I mean, this is why it's just so utterly laughable that anyone could ever say that the church is down on sex. I mean, insofar as the church has said that right experience of sex actually teaches us about the Lord of the universe, it's almost impossible for the church to have a more positive view of sex. It's just like sex, in a sense, reveals God.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what it is.
Yep. That's why I love when, you know, we're pregnant with our fourth and they ask, oh, do you know how that happens? Say, yeah, we really like sex. Don't you? Kind of a thing, playing off that. But I remember Tim Gray, Professor Tim Gray, doing what you kind of just did, Dr. J, where he talked about the Father giving all of himself to the Son giving all of himself back, receiving that. And, yep. And that's the Holy Spirit. And this idea of how, unity,
that love, right, and is the
full,
Holy Spirit. Yeah.
The full gift of self, including my fertility.
Yep.
And for my wife to accept that literally into her body and then give of herself back, including her fertility. That's and right. That it's just like contraception cuts that. It cuts part of who we are out of that full gift.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, when John Paul speaks about lust, for example, Thomas, he always says, like almost as a synonym, whenever he talks about lust, he uses the word reduction. That to experience a person lustfully is to experience a reduction of that person, or only a piece of that person. It's like cutting them apart, if you will. And so what is love all about? Well, love is about a full experience of another human being, and we learn things about ourselves and about the other in that experience. And we're supposed to sort of cut out a dimension of the human being. It's almost like, I think I've heard Christopher West use this analogy. It's like if you were to like meet your wife at the altar, experience your wedding day, go to your wedding night, and then say, babe, I'm not really into your face this evening. Can you put this paper bag over your head while I make love to you? Like, can you imagine doing that?
No.
You know, and just like, what an asshole you would be. Yeah. You know, like, it's like that kind of thing. Like, I'm kind of more into your body than I am into your eyes right now. So would you close them while we have sex? Like that kind of thing just that gives you chills. You want to vomit when you think about it, you know, and it's the full experience of a human person. You know, that is the aim of carnal love, you know, so.
I want to bring up a topic. I want to give it also a shout out to my wife, Alicia, who is an instructor for NFP.
So is my wife.
Which, for those of you who don't know, NFP stands for Natural Family Planning. And just a real quick synopsis of this, there's some amazing realities about the female body, that there are different times throughout the month that they are capable of conceiving and different times in the month where they are incapable of conceiving. And the church has kind of given us some guidelines. And the reality is that you can use NFP without contraceptives or with condoms to be able to have sex in times when you are not capable of conceiving and have sex in times when you are capable of conceiving. And so that concept of natural family planning, I'd love to just tee that up for you, John, to discuss what does the church teach us about NFP? When can we use it? When shouldn't we use it? Because I think that for a lot of our listeners who are married, this is probably a much more poignant topic when it comes to contraception.
It's such a great question and such a meaningful question, you know, especially to the listeners who are married. Natural family planning, you described it very well, Brock, but I, you know, to kind of say it slightly differently, what natural family planning is a way to work with the fullness of a woman's body so as to pursue either pregnancy or to avoid pregnancy at a particular time. But what's key there is that, you know, it's working with the fullness of the body instead of sort of cheating by cutting a part of the body out so as to kind of quickly achieve a particular end.
Gotcha.
Like you said, in natural family planning, there are certain times where it's possible to discern whether or not, or at least likely whether or not, a woman is fertile or infertile, mm-hmm. were you to have intercourse at that time. When can you use natural family planning? Well, in a sense, you can use natural family planning whenever you want to, you know, attempt to pursue pregnancy or to avoid pregnancy, which presumably is just about every time you have sex. What most people are asking about is not so much, okay, when can I use natural family planning to pursue pregnancy? Oftentimes it's, you know, when can I use natural family planning to avoid pregnancy? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is where, you know, the church has a lot to say about what constitutes just cause, mm-hmm. Justa causa, you know, for the use of natural family planning. And the church uses the language that for grave reason, and I think that's like an important term there, grave reason.
And you're quoting from Humanae Vitae directly,
correct,
right?
Yeah. Humanae Vitae, paragraphs 11 and 12, uses the language grave reason. And if individuals have a grave reason to avoid pregnancy at a particular time, Dan, doing so is indeed permissible in the, mm-hmm. in the eyes of the church. So, you know, some people will say, oh gosh, if you're Catholic, you have to have 17 children. Do Catholics have to be open to life? Absolutely. Can a Catholic get married if they are closed to the idea of having children? Actually, no. That would constitute an invalid marriage. So Catholics must be open to children if they are to be legitimately married. Mm-hmm. But they can either pursue or avoid pregnancy depending on their reasons for doing so. Sure. But this is something, you know, that I kind of want to dwell on this for a little while here. John Paul II, who like we said, wrote so much on marriage, family, sexuality, spoke a lot about what he called a contraceptive mentality. Mm-hmm. Okay. He was very careful to note that even in the occasion that a couple is using natural family planning, not wearing a condom, not, you know, doesn't have an IUD or anything, like
not on the pill,
that they're using natural family planning, they can take into their sexual relationship a contraceptive mentality that mimics individuals who are using contraception. And I think that's really key to note, especially as American Catholics.
Yeah.
Because I think it's like, you know, I live in suburban Denver, and you might think, for example, of you know, going to the soccer field, you know, on Saturday morning in Lakewood, Colorado. And so you're there, and you'll see a lot of minivans and American couples that have, you know, 2.3 children, whatever the average is these
days.
And
a dog.
And the dog, you know, or if you're in Denver, maybe just the dog.
In a stroller.
In a stroller, you know. You'll go onto the soccer field, and you'll see all these people who in a sense, almost certainly have a contraceptive mentality. And here's one kind of litmus test that I'll offer for kind of knowing whether or not you have a contraceptive mentality. Have you valued lower goods above the good of another child? Mm.
Which, you know, the church says is the greatest gift of marriage.
That's right.
Cassidy Canubie mentions that's the primary gift, I think, is the language they use. So to your point, it's not just we get married and maybe there's a kid involved. It's like, no, that's central to marriage.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And obviously it's a tragedy. Some people aren't able to have children, and there's no sin in that. Like, let's just be very clear. There is no sin in that. That said, looking, you know, at what the church teaches, you if you go out to your average Saturday morning suburban American soccer game, you'll see people who probably want their children to be in competitive travel soccer leagues more than they want their children to have a sibling.
Mm-hmm. Say that again. I think it's worth repeating.
Okay. Go out on Saturday morning, suburban America, and you will see many people who are far more interested in ensuring that their children are able to participate in competitive travel soccer leagues than in their children having the good of a sibling.
Mm-hmm. So they're sacrificing their family at the altar of enjoyment, pleasure.
Right.
So it could even be we want the next nicer car, or that the job that I have to travel a lot, and if I have more kids, I'm not going to be able to travel more, or if I have more kids, I'm not going to be able to afford this new house or this car, whatever it is, right? So it could be sorts of things, but they're sacrificing family, children, for the sake of what you said, a lower good. Is that what you said?
That's right. Yeah. Like valuing the good. Valuing some other good over the good of a child.
Just because you're using NFP doesn't make it morally permissible.
All right, John, I have one more question here, and this is a podcast specifically for men. And so often we think contraception being taking the pill, right? Because women take it, or the other term, the IUD, is that I called it an IED device. Once, and
she blew up.
There's a lot of similarities if you think about it. But so we, as men, we sometimes think that contraception is just a female thing. But today's title is "Why Can't I Wear a Condom?" Why is contraception specifically? How can it impact or be hurtful to men?
Wow, this is such a good question, and I want to note that the answer that I'm about to give is an answer that I'd love to spend about 3 hours on, but I'm going to give it to you in about two or three minutes.
Yeah, we have about three left.
So as a graduate student, I was reading a man with a very unfortunate name, chief evolutionary biologist out of Rutgers University. His name is Lionel Tiger. You can look him up. Mm. And he wrote an incredible book.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you. I think that's a pretty sweet name.
Lion Tiger. Yeah. And he wrote a book called The Decline of Males on the Crisis of Masculinity, which in his estimation began in the 50s and 60s and continues to the present day. Mm. And when he was looking at all of the factors that contributed to what you might call the crisis of men in our culture, the increased incarceration rates, lower job satisfaction, mm-hmm. more depression, higher divorce rates, and the sociological statistics go on and on and on.
Yeah.
This non-religious evolutionary biologist, you know, kind of asks in his book, what is the chief cause of the decline of men in our culture? And as a non-religious college professor, he says contraception. And he says because it's contraception which chiefly has destroyed the development, the maturity of men in our culture. Beforehand, fatherhood oftentimes made men, you know, into saints. That was sort of the norm, if you will. But if you look throughout history, it's very easy to see, forget history, just on human biology, that human fatherhood is a tenuous thing, at least when compared to motherhood. You know, women spend 9 months with their child. The child is born. The women are so deeply bonded. For a man, you know, an act that can take a minute or two I was wondering if somebody was going to make a joke. an act that can go by quickly, it can be immediately followed by abandonment, and a father's ability to remain committed to his or her children is a relatively difficult task in comparison to women. So there's kind of this tenuous link already between human males and their offspring.
To summarize, it removes all responsibility.
It removes
contraception. Therefore, maturation, sanctification, all of that.
Yeah.
So you remain
that link
child.
Is gone. And so boys remain boys, mm-hmm. and don't become men. And if you want to read more about that, read this guy, The Decline of Males, Lionel Tiger. He's quoted at length also by another incredible theologian named Janet Smith. And I think that there's something about natural family planning, which is the perfect antidote, that it not only fosters a link between father and child, what it also does is it brings about deeper intimacy between couples.
Totally.
Okay, so it's like, you know, women, when they bring children into the world, go through hell. Mm-hmm. That's the ordinary experience of a woman after the fall. And people sometimes don't do natural family planning, you know, men, because it's hard. Mm-hmm. Think about the crucifixion that women go through. And if you want to be united to your bride, can you offer up the temporary sacrifice that natural family planning requires out of a desire for intimacy with her?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's to shift to practicals. Off that point is, as for guys that are actually considering, or with your spouse, you're talking about NFP, natural family planning, do you do it? Do you have a serious reason? I think we need to take into consideration the physical health, the emotional health of our spouse, and
That's
have
right.
that conversation with them. And how are you doing? Is she in a place where we actually need to abstain or pray through that? And if you don't have a serious reason, then you got to remain open
and
to
seek
life.
Counsel, right? Find a spiritual director, get a therapist, find a counselor, like seek counsel on this. This is a big deal.
Yep.
And to think that you can make a decision over dinner one night about contraception or NFP as contraception, that's just not the right approach.
Yep. Think about it, pray about it, talk to your spouse about it, talk to your parish priest about it. As a couple, I think those are great aspects to be able to just welcome another set of eyes into your circumstance. And to be asking, Lord, what do you desire from us as a couple?
Absolutely.
Last comment I will make is just don't be afraid to be open to life, and don't let the culture scare you that having a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth kid, whatever it is, it's hard. But it's to your point, John, fatherhood is one of the paths, along with marriage, of our sanctification.
Yeah.
And be grateful for the miracle that life is, as hard as it can be.
Dr. J, it was so good to have you on today.
Good to be here.
This topic, as you already said, could take hours and hours and many more podcasts. We'd love to have you back on, either to keep going with this topic or another one. You were a fantastic guest. We really look forward to the next time. John, you mentioned summer projects. For any college students listening that want to check out more about summer projects, where can they learn more?
Yeah, I'll just Google Focus Summer Projects. First things that comes up, but you can go to focusoncampus.org/summerprojects as well.
Cool. Yep. And just a reminder to all the guys out there, be sure to like this podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. Share it with your friends. If you have any questions about this topic or other topics, please send them in to mancatholicpodcast@gmail.com. Any topic ideas, we'd love to look at those. That's it for today. Thanks again. God bless.